Welcome to New Books in Language. Today, in the first of two interviews, I talk to James Herford about his work on Language in the Light of Evolution. The OUP have recently published the second volume of this book, entitled The Origins of Grammar, but first we revisit his earlier volume, The Origins of Meaning, originally published in 2007. It's a work of enormous scope, both in its ambition to offer an account of the evolutionary development of language in humans, and in the vast range of scholarship that it draws upon, from linguistics, primatology, semiotics, computational modelling, and much else besides. A major achievement of the book is the way in which it brings so much material together and makes so much contemporary research accessible to a wider audience. In this interview, we only touch upon some of the major themes of the work, the ways in which evolutionary considerations influence, or should influence, how we theorise about language, the possible cognitive and neural bases for distinctively human thought, and how animal communication might have been elaborated into the much richer systems at our disposal. I'm talking to Professor James Herford about The Origins of Meaning, the first volume of his magisterial two-volume work on Language in the Light of Evolution. Jim, what first inspired you to undertake this project?
Well, I've been doing linguistics, I started off as a phonetician, if you include phonetics, for about 50 years. And I've sort of flitted around between various parts of linguistics, touching on most of them. So phonetics, syntax, morphology, semantics, pragmatics. So I've had a rather broad interest. Breadth rather than depth seems to be my way. And then about 20, 25 years ago, I got interested in evolution. Dawkins' book, Selfish Gene, was very influential for me. At that time, I was working with computational linguistics and doing computer programming. So it occurred to me to try to write some simple computer simulations of elements of language evolution. So that's what got me started. And then I started teaching courses on language evolution across the breadth of the parts of language, evolution of sound systems, evolution of syntax, evolution of semantics and pragmatics, and thought I ought to write a book about it. So I started off with the semantics and pragmatics part of the book, and that turned into a whole book. And then, as you know, the syntax book became a book in itself, and I never got around to the sound systems, phonetics and phonology. But watch this space. I'm actually writing now what OUP call a slim guide to the origins of a language, which will have a bit on phonetics and phonology and will condense down a lot of the material from the book we're talking about now and the origins of grammar, and we'll have something on sound systems. So it's been an ongoing project related to teaching, trying basically to bring all of language and linguistics within the scope of evolution. And there's this saying, nothing in biology makes sense except in the light of evolution. And I think that's true in language too. You can only really understand why things are the way they are if you think of how they got to be that way.
Indeed. And although you talk about having a very broad background in linguistics, would it be fair to say that evolutionary approaches to language have been in the recent past somewhat discredited or unpopular, and that you yourself have played a very substantial role in repopularizing these?
Yes, there have been a minority of people who soldiered on regardless. I mean, there was the notorious ban in 1866 for the Parisian Linguistic Society on papers on language evolution, because it was deemed to be too speculative. But that didn't stop people, and there have been people thinking and talking about the evolution of language ever since. Within linguistics, Hockett was one. None of the people in the generative school have devoted any thought to it. They're essentially synchronic linguists. And Philip Lieberman's another one. From very early on, he was talking about the evolution of the human vocal apparatus. So there have been people interested. One of the big breakthroughs was Steven Pinker and Paul Bloom in 1990, who wrote this book called Natural Language and Natural Selection, where they argued that such a complex thing as language, just like such a complex thing as the eye, could only have come about through natural selection. And that was a bit of a breakthrough. For odd reasons, people in the generative school, especially Chomsky, have always resisted the idea that the language capacity could have come about by natural selection. And here's someone closely associated with the generative school, Pinker and Bloom, arguing to the contrary very forcefully. And that was a bit of a watershed. There had been a conference before that in 76, I believe, organized by Stephen Harnad on evolution of language. There was not much follow through from that. And then Chris Knight and I started a series of conferences which have been quite well attended and quite fun, and I guess quite influential. That started in 1996, and they've been going on every 2 years since. There's definitely been a big upsurge in it. Not much in linguistics. I mean, I could count probably on the fingers of two hands the linguists who are actively interested in language evolution. And that's a pity. There are quite a few people outside. And I think that, you know, anthropologists and psychologists, computer scientists even, I think we need input from linguists who know much more about what language is like. But it's growing. This EvoLang conference every 2 years is very interdisciplinary and getting somewhat more technical with each successive conference. So it's beginning to be a bit of a subject.
Going back to the linguists, presumably it's an issue that people can otherwise, if they don't consider evolution, can produce theories that are intrinsically very difficult to reconcile with an evolutionary approach.
Yes, that's certainly true. Maybe a bit of a caricature example is the idea from way back that a language is a set of sentences. And I guess nobody really took that all that... Well, there was a kind of double thing. For the purpose of writing academic articles, it was taken quite seriously that a language is nothing more than a set of sentences. So really a mathematical object, like a natural number. And there's no way you can think of a mathematical object being subject to the forces of evolution, natural selection. So that's a stark caricature example. More recently, Chomsky's been saying that, or he said for a long time, that it's not obvious that the primary purpose of language is communication. So you ask him what it is, and he said, oh, it's an internal computation mechanism. Well, it's possible that that could have arisen by natural selection. So people completely privately being able to solve problems, practical problems, by thinking about them in more complex ways would have had a selective advantage. But it also seems unlikely that communication didn't play a part. People solve problems collectively, not just on their own. And solving problems collectively would involve communication. And the system for communication would have been adapted for solving problems collectively and would have helped the whole group. So there's an element of group selection, which is a kind of natural selection involved there. More generally, though, I think linguists are just stuck in a kind of synchronic rut. I remember being taught that the first thing to do is to describe a language the way it is and never mind about the history. Then a bit later in my career, I was actually made to teach a course on the history of the English language, and it opened the door for me. I realized that English was the way it was because it had a history. But historical linguistics is a subdiscipline that a lot of linguists don't get into. And likewise, evolutionary considerations don't play a large part in most people's thinking.
Do you find historical linguists are receptive to evolutionary approaches, or do they, in some sense, think they don't want to go back that far?
Definitely. On the whole, they're very skeptical about going back any further than about 5,000 years. And it's quite right that the evidence gets very thin. If you're comparing languages, then the similarities between them on which you can build reconstructions run out once you've built back maybe about 5,000 years. On the other hand, there are some contributions that historical linguists make which can lead us to make inferences about much deeper processes. So they talk, for instance, about grammaticalization. So grammaticalization is a largely one-way process by which functional words, little words like to and the, and inflections on verbs and nouns and so on, are produced in the history of a language by being converted from content words, nouns and verbs. That's a one-way process, and if it's a one-way process, then you're forced into the belief that languages have got more complex in those ways over the course of time. So they've developed more functional words, developed more inflections. So there is this one-way process, and you can use that one-way process to project back to what were simpler stages of language. There's always been a political objection within linguistics to talking about simple languages. And that was well motivated, because if you, you know, go to places with simple material cultures, so, you know, you go to the outback in Australia, where people live very materially simple lives, it's wrong to think that their languages are simple. Far from it. Their languages are very complex. So linguists had to fight the battle that people with materially simple lives had complex languages. And so they tended to emphasize that every language is equally complex. Now, that's actually not true. You can find parts of languages which are more complex than other parts of other languages. And you can overall, you can find languages which in some sense are simpler. The whole language is simpler. And we can find in unusual circumstances, we can find cases where what you may or may not want to call languages are really simple. So pigeons, if you put two communities together which don't share a language, then they'll develop one, or at least they'll develop a simple means of communication, which has no grammatical inflections, no function words, but is largely nouns and verbs thrown together. And that is a simple form of language. You see it in the language of two-year-olds, just beginning to learn the language of their community. You see it in the performance of trained apes as well. They string words together in a very simple way with little or no grammar. And those have been called fossils of language. Fossils, not a very good term, actually. But it shows that that people, and incidentally apes, can manage simpler systems. And in the case of people, these lead to more complicated systems. So it's reasonable to think that in the prehistory of humans, that there was a similar process, that that language started off simply and got more complex. This is actually verging on the content of the second book now, the origins of grammar rather than the origins of meaning.
Sure. Would it be fair to say that your general program in the two books is along the lines of attempting to formalize language or to make statements about language which are applicable now, but in some sense are gradable and go and enable us to look back to simpler languages or proto-languages as a process of relatively gradual change?
Yes, I would say that, but I think that's more true in the central parts of the structure of language, like in grammar and in phonology. In the case of semantics and pragmatics, I would say that the basic elements, or at least very simple examples of them, can be found all in animal behavior. They're all there. So I argue, as you know, that you can find predication, you can find reference, you can find deixis. What else is there? Propositional structure in the thought of animals, of non-human animals. So those are all present. Illocution. So people doing things to each other with language. Animals do things to each other through their communicative gestures and displays. So the way I put it is that the tiny seeds of what's essential to language can all be found in animal behavior. Another one that I haven't mentioned is episodic memory. I mean, it used to be said that only humans have a memory for things that have happened to them in person. So remembering where you got out of bed this morning, remembering where you were last night. It's been said that animals don't have that kind of memory. They can remember, they can know their environment. That is, they can know where to find food and so on, but they can't remember specific things that have happened to them. So that's a claim about humans being unique. But as you know, in the book, I've argued that that there's evidence that that non-human animals can remember things that have happened to them and things that they've done. So a classic example of the scrub jays remembering where they've put food and remembering what kind of food it was that they put there and remembering how long ago they put it there. So these are all tiny beginnings. And on the whole, animals, non-human animals, are basically only concerned with food and sex. And humans are motivated by much more than that. So the examples that show up in the animal literature are almost all, even the experimental literature, are almost all connected with food rewards. And humans have progressed beyond that. But nevertheless, those elements, reference, predication, propositional structure, doing things to each other as we do with language, episodic memory, I claim those are all to be found in a very simple form in animal behavior.
I'd like, if I may, to sort of take a tour through some of these in slightly more detail. In the first part of The Origins of Meaning, you give a characterization of semantics that's in some sense workable from an evolutionary standpoint. And at the beginning of the second part, in fact, you do the same for the locutionary acts. Would it be fair to describe this as a very broad construal of semantics from a linguist's point of view?
Yes, it is. There's an essential difference. So many semanticists, wrongly I believe, the way they treat semantics is as a direct relation between language and the world. The word tree relates to a set of things out there in the world which happen to be trees. A proper name like Chris relates to you, the individual you. And these treatments of semantics bypass the human mind. They bypass concepts. So going way back, Ogden and Richards set out what they called a triangle of signification, I think they called it. So basically an indirect relationship between language and the world, where the world is outside us, is conceived inside us in terms of mental constructs, concepts. And then the words we have are words for those concepts. They're not words for things, they're not directly words for things in the world, but words for things in the head. So my take on semantics is that it's a relationship between concepts and the world. And then in the evolution of language, what happened is that public symbols got associated with the private concepts which animals had of elements of their world. I start with a view of semantics which is maybe paradoxically nothing to do with language, but on which the semantics of language can be built. So semantics for me is the relationship between the world and organisms, thoughts and ideas and concepts of what the world is like, which may be quite complex, these thoughts, quite well structured. And then along comes public language, where individuals start communicating to each other about their thoughts, and having lived in the same environment and having had similar experiences, the thoughts they have in their heads are pretty similar to each other. So communication about the things out there in the world is possible. So the take on semantics is consistent with ideas in linguistics about semantics. So you can accommodate ideas like reference and truth. So rather than saying that a word refers, I would say that a concept refers, and a word only indirectly refers to things because the concept corresponding to the word refers to things. So reference is a relationship between what's in our heads and what's out there in the world, and we have words for what's in our heads, and so reference becomes a relationship between the words and the world. It's maybe an unorthodox take on semantics, but I think it's completely compatible with the orthodox view if you take a conceptualist position.
towards the end of the first part of the book, you explore some of the possible underpinnings of this sort of proto-propositional system. You explore this rather fascinating idea that there's something in the neurological distinction between the dorsal and the ventral pathways, the where and what streams that equips humans and certain other animals to entertain these proto-propositions. I wonder, could you expand on that a little?
Yes. If you read any logic book, the structure of a proposition, which is the basic element in any logical system, has two elements in it. It's got the predicates and arguments. And the way logic textbooks introduce this is typically by saying, for example, a proposition might be that John sleeps. And so the predicate part is what's asserted of John, that he sleeps. And the argument part of the proposition is the term referring to John. Logicians also allow a different kind of argument to a predicate, which is something which doesn't refer at all. It's empty. It stands in for anything to which the predicate can apply. So it's a way of saying, for example, something is sleeping, or something is noisy around here, or something is smelly around here, for example. You're not sure what it is, but you know of whatever it is that it's smelly or noisy or whatever. And so I take that form of proposition with an so-called empty argument as being the basic kind. And it turns out that in neuroscience, you can find different brain mechanisms which basically correspond to locating an empty object, locating an object that you don't know anything about, apart from the fact that you know it's there. That's one brain mechanism, that's the dorsal mechanism. And another mechanism which, once you've paid attention to it, will tell you what kind of thing it is. So these mechanisms are called the what stream and the where stream. The where stream kicks in first, so something catches your attention. At that point, it all happens extremely fast, of course. At that point, you're simply aware that there's something there. And that would be the empty argument that one is aware of. And then immediately, having paid attention to it, you start making judgments about it. You decide what color it is, how big it is, and then eventually you might decide, aha, it's a face. You might even further on decide whose face it is. These are all sequential processes in the brain. But it's well known that these two pathways, the where pathway, which simply becomes aware of an entity in the environment, and the what pathway, which then delivers judgments about what it is, these exist in non-human animals. So the first discovery of these was in macaques, monkeys, which are primates, but they're not the most closely related animals to humans. When you think about it, it's not at all surprising that that there should be these mechanisms. So we know that attending to something is crucial for you to be able to make any judgment about it and decide how to deal with it. So having an attention-delivering mechanism is plausible, and then having a judgment-forming decision mechanism that tells you, you know, what kind of thing this is that you're looking at is also plausible. Animals negotiating the world need to have their attention drawn to things and then need to be able to decide what they are and how to deal with them. So it's not very surprising, actually. And what I claim is that basically logicians have had it right all along, but the basic structure of thought has these two components, the bare thing, and then whatever judgments, I've called them, or predicates, like what color it is, what size it is, that apply to the bare thing. So the logicians have had it right all along, basically, that there is this distinction between predicate and argument. The important step was taken by Frege, who identified these elements of the proposition, and this replaced the thought which had been going for 2,000 years, Aristotelian thought, which was much more closely based on language. So the idea that there's a subject and a predicate in any thought is now more complicated. Well, in one way more complicated, in one way more simple. But basically the claim is we don't think so much in words, but we think in these propositional structures, and animals do too.
Is the usefulness or the power of propositional thinking part of the evolutionary story about why these two brain mechanisms formed up separately, or is it some kind of acceptation?
Well, as I say, non-human animals have these two brain mechanisms, and I don't know about fish, but I would suspect that that all mammals and probably all birds have these two brain mechanisms as well. So any organism that that picks out individual objects in the world and then has to decide what to do with them, you know, whether to eat them or whether to run away from them or swim away from them, I would imagine that that there will be similar mechanisms in any organism like this. So they're extremely ancient, I would guess, these mechanisms. So they're adaptive from that point of view. You mentioned exaptation. It's possible that that the two-part structure of human sentences is somehow just built on top of that. Think of our thought has got these two elements to it, and so the sentences that we use in communication should have these two elements to it. An interesting case, I think, here is the case of weather terms. Thoughts about the weather are actually rather exceptional. There's no object which is doing anything. It's not like something grabbing your attention and you deciding that it's red. So basically, you're just aware that rain is happening, or that snow is happening, or that it's hot. But it's interesting that in languages we have to express that with a two-part bit. We have to say it is hot. Just saying hot is not good English. And languages do it in different ways. So in Arabic, they say the world is hot. And in Russian, they do it the other way around. So the meaningful bit goes in the noun, not in the verb. So they say rain goes or snow goes. But it's interesting that they have to say it in two parts. And maybe that's built on the habit of thinking in two parts about objects. So weather is exceptional, and somehow you make your thought about weather conform to your thought about objects. You imagine an it which is doing the raining, or a world which is doing the raining.
I think it's a very interesting observation. What I had in mind was maybe even a more speculative question about whether there was something intrinsic to the nature of the system of thinking that happens because we have these two pathways that was so useful as to justify the maintenance of a twin system of this kind, or whether you felt the two pathways arise simply for purely practical reasons of the way it suits the brain to treat the recognition of objects or the property description of objects.
Yes, I think that is what you say is right, that it's any creature which negotiates the world and deals selectively with different objects, so picks them out and then decides what to do with them and how to react to them, I think will have these two different mechanisms. There have been philosophers who have speculated about possibly more simple ways of thinking. They're called feature systems, I think, which are basically much more like the way we think about, well, the way weather seems to work. That is basically the structure of a thought is not built around identification of an object and then saying something or thinking something about it, but just treating the world as a set of one-place judgments like rain, smelly, hot, and I think Strawson's point is that it's hard to imagine doing the complicated things we do in the world with only a simple way of thinking like that. So this propositional thought is highly adaptive, I would say. That's not actually something that I argue in the book. I just argue that it's the basis of language. We express propositions in language, and you can find proposition-like structure in animal thought as well.
And you go on to conclude the first section of the book by articulating a semantics based on one-place predicates, in which complex predicates are in some sense unpacked into simpler forms.
Yeah.
Obviously, this isn't quite as simple as the weather simplicity. Is there a limitation to one place predicate thinking if you were to implement that in a system? Or do you think that could actually be a psychologically plausible way of articulating human semantics as it currently is?
Well, that part of the book is more of an experiment than, and I'm not entirely happy with it, but I pushed the line that we can analyze complex propositions in terms of one place predicates only. So this dorsal ventral separation can only be made to apply to one place predicates. And obviously, when we talk, we talk about relations between objects. So, you know, John gave Mary a book, for example, has got three arguments to the predicate give. So I have a problem there. How can you reduce everything to one place predicates? I grasped at an idea which comes out of psychology, which is a distinction between global attention and local attention. So one can attend to a whole scene and decide what kind of a scene it is. So in the example of John giving Mary a book, I would claim that one can take in the whole scene and decide that what characterizes that scene is giving. So it's a giving scene. And then within global attention, one can attend to the individual objects. So one can attend to John and decide that that thing is John. One can attend to the book and decide that that thing is the book. And to Mary, decide that that thing is Mary. So again, there's something complicated going on in the brain, like the dorsal and ventral mechanisms. Only in this case, it's a distinction between interacting of two different kinds of attention. Attention to a whole scene, of which you make a judgment, and attention to the parts of that scene, again, of which you make one-place judgments. So I think to some extent that will hold up. In the psychological literature, there are cases where pathological cases where people with particular disabilities can only do one or the other. So there's this condition called simultanagnosia, and that's sometimes loosely described as being only able to see one thing at a time. So a classic case is if someone is shown a rectangle made up of dots, they can either only see the rectangle or they can only see the dots. And, for example, they couldn't count the dots because counting dots means that you're able to see more than one. So they can only attend to one object at a time in this pathological case. I'm helped out a bit also by theoretical semanticists, by logicians who in the case of event semantics, have taken a similar line. So in the case of John giving Mary a book, they would describe that as being an event of giving, and there's a one-place predicate applying to the whole event, and then within that there are participants. So I've got respectable counterparts, both in the psychological literature and the pathology, and in the semantic, very armchair-bound theoretical literature as well. I'm not completely comfortable with that whole account because of two-place predicates like position predicates, like on. The book is on the table. And somehow it just seems a bit artificial to say that one perceives that as an onness situation with two participants. I'm a bit uneasy about that. But in the case of actions, it doesn't seem too bad to me. Let me just mention one more thing, which I think I didn't mention in this book, but is mentioned in the other. In Nicaraguan Sign Language, when in the very first stages of the development of sign language, the first signers would use very simple expressions to describe rather complicated events. So one of these Nicaraguan kids was shown a video of a man pushing a woman and a woman falling over. So we would describe that in English, say, as the man pushed the woman over. So a two-place predicate, man pushed the woman. So push with two arguments, woman and man. But what the kid did was basically break it up into two elements. He said, or he signed, man push, pause, woman fall. So the very basic form of the growing language there was, again, one-place predicates, man push. There's some pushing going on by a man. and there's some falling going on by a woman. And then what happened later on in the development of Nicaraguan Sign Language is that the push and the fall got squished together. So you get man, push-fall, woman, or man, woman, push-fall. So there's some interesting developments there, and one could perhaps mount an argument, I don't mount it in detail, but the early stages of language did involve all one-place predicates. There's also some arguments in the next book about how this relates to serial verbs that you find in some languages too.
In the previous chapter, you also raised the idea that there might be a connection between the limits we have in the number of things we can simultaneously attend to and the number of arguments that we're allowed to have in our predicates.
Yes.
I wonder, did you see those attentional limits as something that's potentially changed evolutionarily, humans maybe moving up from simple one-place predicates to something more complicated, or have we just become maybe better at switching attention or some similar?
Well, the number of objects that we can keep track of in a moving scene is limited to about four. So remember, I say, even though I push the line of everything being reducible to one-place predicates, remember that there are predicates of events which have participants, and the number of participants in an event that we conceive of or understand is limited to about four. Now, work on primates seems to show a similar limit. That is, the number of objects that a chimpanzee can keep track of at once is limited to about four. The judgments that a chimpanzee can make about how many objects there are in a collection at a glance is limited to about four, and that's the same as humans. The distinction between local and global attention is also found in non-human animals too. So they found it in pigeons even. So I don't think that you can say that if we're comparing birds, mammals, and humans, that there's any development there. We're all stuck in the same or very, very similar limitations. We can attend to about the same number of objects in a scene. We can make a one-place judgment about each object and about the scene as a whole. And that's common to human thought and quite a bit of non-human thought as well. So I wouldn't say that there's any progression. Obviously, with language, we're now able to express quite complex thoughts with subordinate clauses and remember the sentences themselves. And that may give us a way, in fact, I'm sure it does, give us a way of thinking more complex thoughts than we could without language. But without the involvement of language, I think there's very little difference between what we can think and what some of our close relatives can think.
Turning then, if I may, to the second part of the book,
yeah.
You, as you put it, go public and talk about communication.
Yeah.
Definitions here can sometimes be rather elusive, again, as you discuss. What's your view on what constitutes communication?
Well, I just had a look at those that chapter again, and I realized that I basically ducked it. And I turned the fact that it's difficult to define communication to advantage by saying, well, communication evolves out of non-communication. In fact, if you're thinking evolutionarily, everything of a certain type evolves out of something that previously wasn't of that type. So language evolves out of non-language. Humans evolve out of non-humans. So there are things that we might not want to call communication now, but which nevertheless were the evolutionary precursors of communication. So it's not easy to, or it's rather arbitrary to put a line around exactly what is communication. But I'll be a bit more helpful on that. For practical purposes, communication is intentional behavior, which is made to influence the behavior of another person in such a way that the person affected understands that that's what's intended.
I think I know people here who will be very pleased to hear that, actually. You go on a couple of chapters later to address the question of why it should be adaptive to communicate. This is something that's sort of intuitively very obvious because it's so useful, but it's quite difficult to articulate an explanation at an individual level, isn't it?
It is, yes. So communication seems altruistic. That is, we're giving information away, which might be useful to us, and making it available to other people would seem to be against our interests. So there is, at first sight, there's a kind of a paradox there. Why should we give valuable information away to other people? But I think it's very easily resolved. Once you accept that we live in a cooperative society, so we live in groups which cooperate with each other, and each individual benefits from living in a cooperative group. So to be a member of a cooperative group, you sometimes give information to other people in the expectation that other people will reciprocally give you information later on. It's tit-for-tat strategy. And that works to the benefit of the group, and it works to the benefit of individuals. So we end up with no great puzzle there, unless you say that the puzzle is pushed back. That is, how do we get to be so cooperative in the first place? And it's clear that that human groups, social groups, are much more cooperative internally than other animal groups. Nevertheless, you know, on some kind of a scale through monkeys and apes, it's evident that chimpanzees, for example, are more cooperative within their groups than groups of monkeys, for example. There's some cooperation among groups of chimpanzees who hunt monkeys, but more cooperation than there is among wolves and lions, for example. So again, there's some kind of a gradual progression, a degree of cooperativeness in chimpanzees, but a far, far greater degree of cooperativeness in humans. And quite how we got to be so cooperative is still not completely understood. But I think it's accepted that we are.
You also present and discuss some very interesting work on the possible emergence of referring expressions, these triadic relations. In particular, you mentioned a study by Zuberbühler and colleagues that sets out to distinguish between an animal just reacting to an alarm call and it showing signs of awareness that the call refers to a particular predator.
Yeah.
Could you tell us about the implications of that, in your view?
Well, it's the classic example of vervet monkeys has them giving three kinds of alarm call, one for pythons, one for eagles, and one for leopards. When they see a leopard, they give a so-called bark. And when they hear a bark, they run up a tree, which is a smart thing to do if there's a leopard around. Some people have seen in this the origins of reference. That is, they say that what the vervet monkey is doing is actually holding the concept of a leopard in its head and communicating the concept of a leopard to the other vervets. People who don't like that way of thinking, who think it's attributing too much to the monkeys, say no. What's happening is really that separately but in parallel, they've developed a disposition to give the bark call when they see a leopard, and then complementarily, when they hear a bark call, climb up a tree, but without the concept of a leopard entering their heads when they hear the bark call. Now, what Klaus Zuberbühler has done is very cleverly. He's gone out into the forest in, I think he's in Côte d'Ivoire in Africa, and where there are monkeys who make similar alarm calls, not vervets actually, these are Diana monkeys. The Diana monkeys, like the vervets, they have one alarm call for leopards and another alarm call for predatory birds like eagles. And the animals themselves, the leopards and the eagles, make characteristic noises. So the leopard gives a growl, and the eagle gives a screech. And these noises made by the predators are obviously quite different from the alarm calls. What Zuberbühler has done is he tape-recorded, for example, the alarm call meaning, if you allow the term, meaning leopard, and tape-recorded the growl of a leopard, and also tape-recorded the screech of an eagle. So he'll play the alarm call for leopard to the monkeys, and they look suitably worried and begin to climb the trees. And then he'll play, 5 minutes later, he'll play the screech of an eagle, and they react as if the presence of an eagle. But if 5 minutes later he had played the growl of a leopard, they're not so perturbed. That is, they've already, the interpretation is, they've already become aware through the alarm call of the presence of a leopard nearby. So when they hear the leopard growl, they're not particularly bothered. And he's done it the other way around, of course. He's played the eagle alarm call, followed by either the eagle screech or the leopard growl. In the case where he plays the eagle alarm call, followed by leopard growl, then there's more panic, hey, new predator around. In the case where he plays the eagle alarm call, followed by eagle screech, less panic, because the interpretation is they knew about the eagle already. So the concept of an eagle was present in their mind, at least for that 5 minutes. He doesn't make any stronger claims than that. And this actually goes back to an earlier discussion of episodic memory and object permanence. So animals can keep in mind an object they've been aware of, even when they're not experiencing it anymore, for short periods of time. As you know, I use that as the basis for human talk about things which are not present.
To conclude our discussion of this volume, I have to ask, there are so many theories on the table as to why language evolved, or out of precisely what immediate sort of precursor or function. Do you have a preference, personally, or do you try to be agnostic between these various ideas?
I think there's a growing consensus that despite some linguists' claim, that there has to have been some continuity between human language and animal behavior. The biggest gap, and you find this quite a bit even in people discussing the evolution of language, is between animal calls and human words. And the gap there is because animal calls are largely, although not entirely, involuntary, whereas the words we use are almost entirely voluntary. That is, we think about them and we choose the words we use. So I think the big movement has been a transition from involuntary signals to voluntary control of signals. You can begin to see this a bit in animal behavior, in that even in the case of the vervets, they don't always give the bark when they see a leopard. If there are no other vervets around, they don't bother. And so that can be interpreted as them choosing not to give it because there's no point. On the other hand, there's quite a bit of compulsion over which the vervets have no control. So in the neuroscience, for example, there's no direct connection from the motor cortex, from the neocortex, to the larynx, the vocal mechanism. So they're not able to control their vocalizations to anything like the same extent as humans. And I think what must have happened in the case of humans is that we gradually made a transition from innate, involuntary vocal behavior to learned, voluntary vocal behavior. That's my preference. The gradualness, I think, most people are beginning to come around to. The aspect that you mentioned about restriction to one-place predicates, there's certainly a puzzle there how we came to be able to express complex sentences involving what we now take to be two- and three-place predicates. I'm still open to persuasion about what may have happened there.
Well, I look forward to having the opportunity to talk to you again about the second volume and possibly to ask all the questions that haven't yet occurred to me about what you've said today. For now, Jim Herford, let me say thank you very much for your time.
Okay, you're welcome. Bye-bye.
I've been talking to James Herford about The Origins of Meaning. This is Chris Cummins for New Books in Language, saying thank you for listening.